Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the January issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. Good Family, From Kids to Money, What You Need to Know, The New Drug Alert. If you're wondering about those new bold alerts on your drugstore cold medications, here's what's up. About 1 in 10 U.S. teens have tried getting high off medications with dextromethorphan, or DXM. Kids call it robo-tripping, or dexing, or triple-seeing, and take as much as 50 times the recommended dose, which can cause hallucinations that can impair their judgment and potentially damage their still-developing brains. The alerts were added to inform parents and to get them talking. When kids learn about the dangers of drugs from their parents, they're half as likely not to abuse them, says Edward Bower, Ph.D., chief of the Division of Medical Toxicology at the University of Massachusetts. Bower suggests that when children are around age 8, you should explain to them, friends may offer you drugs. It's not always shady characters like you see on TV. Substance abuse in any form is unacceptable. With older kids, discuss the risk and go to stopmedicineabuse.org. Do it together to read for more information. A better bedtime. A better bedtime. Resolve to help your kid's clock more quality snooze time. It could benefit your child's mood in a big way. In a recent Columbia University medical study, teenagers who parents let them stay up until midnight or later were 24% more likely to get depressed and 20% more likely to have suicidal thoughts than kids who hit the sack at 10 p.m. or even earlier. Another family article is called Raising a Good Loser by Andrew Postman. The tennis club where Peter played was fed up with the talented boy's tantrums on the court. So were his parents. They agreed to suspend the 12-year-old for 6 months. Howie, too, was a talented athlete. He played almost every sport and whined in all of them when things didn't go his way. His friends, me included, couldn't change him, and his parents didn't seem to try. One afternoon in a neighborhood baseball game, 12-year-old Howie tried to stretch a double into a triple and was easily tagged out. He protested, began to cry, and appealed to his teammates to join him in getting the call reversed. But we agreed with the ump. Howie turned purple with rage, took his ball and bats, and went home. In the first case, Peter, not his real name, saw that the club and his parents meant business. After 6 months of being denied tennis, his greatest pleasure, Peter, real name Beyond Borg, had learned a vital lesson. He grew up to be not only one of the greatest players in history, but a gentleman in victory and, yes, in defeat. In the second case, Howie, his real name, because I hope he reads this and recognizes himself for the jerk he was and still may be, never learned. His parents seemed to ignore and indulge his behavior, and his friendship with me and our teammates didn't survive the day we called him out at third base. It's easy to see that the approach apparently taken by Howie's parents, ignoring bad behavior, is not an effective way to teach a kid how to lose gracefully. It's harder to know what is. We accept that success is just about impossible if you don't know how to use your flops. I have not failed 700 times. I have failed only once, Thomas Edison bristled when asked about the staggering number of false starts before he created a functioning light bulb. I have succeeded in proving that those 700 ways will not work. But it's one thing to understand intellectually the bumper sticker truths about failing. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. No one wins all the time. And another to embrace them when it's your kid who's hurting. Which test am I supposed to want to see her fail so she can build character? A friend says of her 13-year-old daughter. Which boy do I want to not dance with her and break her heart because it will be good for her in the long run? We want our kids to deal with loss or failure constructively by evaluating why things turned out the way they did, asking themselves how they might do better next time, and ultimately bouncing back from disappointment. At the same time, we want their suffering to be minimal. In striving for the latter, though, we may dilute their chance to learn resilience. One of the main jobs of parents is building and protecting their children's self-esteem, says Stanford University psychologist Carol Dweck, who studies how success is achieved. Unfortunately, she says, many parents today believe a good way to do this is to ignore their kids' failures or blame them on someone else. It used to be that after a little league game, parents might say, when you struck out, maybe you didn't have your eye on the ball. Now they're more likely to say, the umpire robbed you, when there are problems. But the child who absorbs that lesson never learns to accept responsibility or withstand adversity. Real protection, says psychologist Wendy Mogul, means teaching children to manage risks on their own, not shielding them from every hazard. You can help your child become a better risk manager, i.e. loser, by cultivating a proper outlook early, says Dweck. In her book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, she describes two basic worldviews. People with a fixed mindset regard their qualities, IQ, personality, even moral character, as unchanging, carved in stone. A fixed mindset creates an urgency to prove yourself over and over, she says. People with a growth mindset, on the other hand, view their basic qualities as improvable through effort and experience. Depending on the mindset they develop with our help, children have vastly different reactions to failures and losing. Confronted by failure, fixed mindset kids fall apart or become very defensive, Dweck says. They either feel really bad about failure or run away from it. Children who have been encouraged to have a growth mindset, on the other hand, believe that they can try to do better. No, they're not happy about a future of rejection, but afterwards, Dweck says, they think about what happened and what they can do to change the outcome next time. To help your kid develop the growth mindset so that she can cope with and learn from, in short, succeed at failure, consider these pointers from parents and parenting experts. Praise the right things. Whether your kid comes home with an A or an F on a school paper, Dweck suggests, don't focus on the grade, but instead ask about what he or she learned. Kids who are praised for effort and strategy remain engaged by challenge, she says. And even after hard work, she still comes home with a D. Praise the effort, but acknowledge that that the result might not be what the child had hoped for, Dweck says. I would say, you really tried, but it looks like there are still things you don't understand. Let's talk about what you can do to get help. Praise is merited, too. If a child falters after taking on a significant challenge, say, enrolling in a difficult class on a subject he's passionate about, but earning low marks, says psychologist Lawrence Kuttner, focus not on the grade, but on his taking on the challenge. Even if the school pressures him to get good grades, let him know what you believe in the long run. Accepting a challenge was the most important thing. Clarify what constitutes losing or failure. How do you help your child see the victory or defeat is not the only ultimate measure of success? The more parents convey to their children that they value the process the kids engage in rather than the outcome, the less the children will worry about losing or failing, the more readily they'll bounce back, and they'll learn more from it. A parent could say, for me, a success is when someone prepares well for something they care about and give it their full effort. You did that. Dweck suggests this exercise. When the family is sitting around the dinner table, parents ask, who did something really hard today? Who made a mistake they can learn from today? Who struggled with something today? Mom and Dad must participate. Don't sugarcoat. Everyone fails. You might as well put that on the table sooner than later. There are bound to be flubbed lines in a school play or a fall at the ballet recital. When my younger son Charlie got his first taste of Little League pitching, he gave up a bunch of runs, including a grand slam. As the opposing players raced around the bases to score, my mind raced for the best way to save his ego. When the inning was finally over, in the meantime, his coach trotted out to the mound, sometimes the loneliest place on the earth, put his hand on Charlie's shoulders and said something to him. Whatever it was, my son stood tall and continued throwing hard strikes. Later, I asked the coach what he said. I told him, "So you got tattooed. Join the crowd." Says Dweek, "To deny that things didn't go well is to send a very dangerous message, that mistakes or losses are so terrible that we can't talk about them. The most successful people know how to confront their failures and deficiencies and take steps to remedy them." That's what you need to teach your child. Say something like, "Well, you lost the election. When you run again, do you think you'll prepare differently? What might you do next time to get more votes?" Leave your own hang-ups at the door. Sometimes what we view as intolerable to our kids is really intolerable to us. Beth, the name has been changed, a Philadelphia mom, was crushed when her 12-year-old wasn't chosen for the middle school's highly regarded orchestra. It was really the first time in her life she didn't get what she wanted. I was devastated and ready to intervene with the school. But before I could, she made the best of the situation and quickly became the proudest, most gung-ho member of her French club. There were nights when I'd watch her sleep in and actually think, "Why aren't you devastated? What's wrong with you?" I realized that I needed to separate her disappointments from mine, that I was confusing from my childhood. When you notice that you're more upset about a setback than your child is, Dweek suggests, consider what the failure means to you and how that's different for what it means to her. Then remind yourself that she'll learn more from this experience if it's not about you, but about her and her growth. Lend your kids some calm. Children throw temper tantrums when they lose or for other reasons because they're emotionally overwhelmed and unable to put their intense feelings into words. For 3 to 5-year-olds, that's normal. For 8, 9, and 10-year-olds, it's worrisome. As a parent, what do you want when your kid, having been shut out of a prize at the talent show, morphs into the demon sea child before your eyes? That's besides feeling paranoid that every parent is watching you. Let your child essentially borrow your control, advises Kuttner. First, if he's small, say 4 or 5, physically pick him up and move him, even if it's just 3 feet away. If he's too old to be carried, gently walk with him elsewhere. That gives the message that you're in control. Talk calmly. Give him the words to put into perspective. Say something like, "It must be very frustrating right now," or "You couldn't get what you wanted." Most kids will calm down very quickly. Adds Attilia Circanu, a child and adolescent psychiatrist in the Boston area, distract, redirect. If the post-failure reaction is either too severe, crying, anger, or too stoic, then distract your child with something neutral. Offer her a snack or suggest a different type of activity, walking, riding her bike, watching TV. Follow her lead. If she wants to talk about the loss, do so without overacting, but by gently exploring. Ask questions like, "What happens next? How do you feel now?" What a bad loser needs most, says educator Alfie Kahn, the author of Unconditional Parenting, is TLC. The best way to immunize kids against the hurt of failure, he says, is to let them know every day that we love them for who they are, not for what they do. They don't have to feel that our love for them doesn't diminish one bit when they fall or screw up. Save $100 or more a month. Despite the credit crunch, refinancing your mortgage may be your key to saving big. By Kelly Grant. When Decima Cooper purchased her first home near Dallas in 2004, she anticipated selling the property for a profit in 5 years. Unfortunately, the recession erased that option. "Now I'm considering refinancing," said Cooper last fall. A lower monthly payment would eliminate her credit card debt and maybe even let her redo the kitchen to improve the home's value. But since she'll like to revisit selling in a few years, presumably when the economy has improved, Cooper wasn't sure the math would work in her favor. She had a low 5.29% rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage. What to do? Cooper isn't the only one crunching numbers these days. Refinancing accounted for roughly 66% of mortgage applications in October, said Mortgage Bankers Association. No doubt driven by homeowners' urge to nab those historic low rates and lower their bills. The credit crunch has made banks more selective on who's eligible, but there's still some opportunity, especially if you have good credit. That said, refinancing costs you time and money. You'll most likely benefit from it if, one, you can lower your rate by half a point or more. As a general rule of thumb, it's worth looking into refinancing if the going rate is 50% lower than your current mortgage if you plan to stay in your home, says Timothy McFarlane, a real estate lawyer in California. For example, someone 5 years into a $200,000 30-year loan at 6% could cut her monthly payment by $125 by refinancing at 5.5%, which shouldn't be too hard. 30-year mortgage rates have hovered between 5 and 5.5% for months now and dip below the 5% mark at press time. The catch: the cost to refinance, including points and closing costs, can amount to 2 to 4% of the new loan value, eating into the savings. Many consumers these days will need at least 1% difference in rate to truly come out ahead, said McFarlane. Banks are also employing stricter credit and equity requirements for borrowers to earn their best rates, which means you'll want to shop around to see which is the best offer. Check with the bank that currently holds the mortgage. It may well offer no-fee refinancing in hoping of keeping your business. Also, be sure to approach community banks and credit unions. They traditionally offer lower rates than big chains. Cooper is planning to sit tight with her existing loan if she can't find a rate low enough to justify the energy and money required to refinance. Point two, you need extra cash. It had become a standard practice for families to tap their home values via home equity loans to pay off debts or college tuition. Now, however, as home prices have plunged, banks have become increasingly reluctant to let homeowners borrow this way, even freezing or closing existing lines of credit. But people with a lot of equity can achieve the same liquidity through easy-to-access cash-out refinances. The application process is the same for a regular refinance, but the new loan will be for more than the borrower currently owes, so she can pocket the difference. Someone who owes $90,000 on a $200,000 mortgage, for example, could refinance for $120,000 and walk away with $30,000 in cash. When you sell your home, the cash out is considered part of the profit, generally taxable only in the excess of $500,000 for a married couple filing jointly. There is a limit, however, to how much cash you can squeeze out through refinancing. Banks typically want to retain at least 30% equity in the new loan, meaning you can borrow up to 70% of your home's current value. You may also pay higher fees at closing, depending on how much cash you take. Ask about the restrictions and charges while shopping around. Don't be shy about mentioning how you plan to use the cash. Lenders may offer sweeter terms for borrowers who are remodeling, which increases the home values, or paying off high interest debt, which can be perceived as reducing their risk. 3. Your adjustable rate mortgage is resetting before you plan to sell. As the economy recovers, interest rates have nowhere to go but up. With that in mind, homeowners with adjustable rate mortgages may want to refinance into a fixed loan sooner rather than later. That's especially true for folks with excellent credit who took advantage of easy-to-obtain financing to get bigger mortgages than their income qualified them for. Wondering if you fall into that category? If it includes anyone with a mortgage payment and other monthly debt obligations, such as car loan or credit card bills, that amount to more than 40% of your take-home pay. Over the short term, you may miss a year at low interest rates because some ARMs are resetting at less than 5%. But by refinancing, you could save thousands over the life of your loan as rates climb and lock in at an affordable monthly payment. The only folks with adjustable rate mortgages who should not reset are those who plan to sell their home before their loans reset to a rate above today's averages. But there's one time you definitely shouldn't refinance. If you might sell your home in the next 2 years, if you're planning on moving in the near term, you're wasting money by refinancing. The goal is to stay put until the monthly savings from your new lower payment have more than offset the refinancing fees. If a lender charged you $1,500 for a new mortgage that would cut your monthly bills by $100, for example, you shouldn't move for at least 15 months. Ideally, you want to stay longer to actually save some cash and profit on the transaction. So be cautious about accepting refinancing terms that won't allow you to break even within 2 years. Most people move a lot more than they think, he says, and in this economy, you never know when you might need to sell your home to secure a new job elsewhere or to cut costs still further. So can you refinance? To get the green light, you'll need a credit score of 600 or even 700 and up on the 300 to 850 point scale. That measures how well you manage your debt. The national median is 720 points. Also, you'll need a good debt-to-income ratio. And the more equity you have in your home, the better, meaning your mortgage will ideally be less than 70 to 80% of your home's value. However, the federal government has pushed lenders to refinance mortgages underwritten by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, even when the owner owes 25% more than the home's value. So if your home is mortgaged for $250,000, but it's now worth $200,000 due to the slumping real estate prices, you may still be eligible for a new loan. Help from the Good Housekeeping Research Institute on your sign. Ask our expert. Question: why aren't all the ingredients in the cleaning product listed on the label? Answer: companies are required by law to list any ingredients with potential risks, such as an eye or skin irritants, on the label, along with handling, storage, and first aid information. And beginning this month, the cleaning product industry is initiating a voluntary program in which companies like Procter & Gamble will disclose ingredients of cleaners, air fresheners, polishers, and more, listing them in descending order of concentration. This info can be obtained on the label at the manufacturer's website or through a toll-free line. Two other big players launched disclosure plans earlier this year: Clorox and SC Johnson. Good Housekeeping to the Rescue: Pain in the Necklace. A reader writes in, I bought a $300 diamond pendant at jcpenney.com last May. Right after clicking submit, I remembered I had a 15% off coupon. I didn't know how to cancel the order, so I bought a second pendant with a discount, figuring I'd just return the full price one. A few days later, JCPenney's customer service called to ask if I meant to order two pendants. We canceled the first order. When the second pendant arrived, I decided I didn't like it. I mailed it back and have a receipt that the post office delivered it. 3 months and several phone calls later, I haven't received a credit. I've accrued late fees and finance charges on my credit card, waiting for the refund to post. Here is Good Housekeeping solution. JCPenney looked into your account and found that the confusion came about the return process. Although you shipped the order back to the factory, no one there alerted the department at JCPenney that handles returns, which is why you didn't receive your refund. JCPenney is crediting your card and covering the delinquency fees. They also sent you a $50 gift card to make up for the inconvenience. So here's Good Housekeeping's suggestions for happier returns. When you buy online, read the return policy with care, noting the return time frame. Check the number of days you have and whether the clock starts ticking from the day of purchase or the day of receipt. In-store options. Large retailers like JCPenney may let you return online purchases at a local store. Shipping charges. These may not be refunded unless the item arrived damaged or it isn't what you ordered. If free shipping required a minimum purchase and a return lowers the total, you may be retroactively charged. Triathlon of Hope. When It Really Counted, My Sons Were a Dream Team by Sally Coslow. Last year, I found myself in one of the last places anyone wants to be in, an oncologist office. My son, Nate, 25, a TV assistant in Los Angeles, had just been diagnosed with incurable, though thank God, treatable lymphoma. What made this even more surreal was that exactly a year earlier, he completed a triathlon sponsored by Team and Training and had raised $6,400 for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Could Nate have had lymphoma when he did the triathlon? I asked the doctor. Most likely, he said. Nate began treatment, followed by a wait to see if the drugs worked. That's when I got a second, happier surprise. He felt well enough to do another race, and his doctor agreed. As Nate's story ricocheted throughout our network of friends and family, this time he raised almost $25,000. One top giver was his older brother, Jed, a lawyer in New York City. My sons are as different as they are close. While Nat might be running, biking, skiing, or snowboarding, you'll find Jed cooking, homemade sausage, anyone, or perhaps reading a novel. His idea of sport was bocce in a bar. Nonetheless, Jed announced that he, too, had committed to a triathlon to benefit the leukemia and lymphoma. Even better, he formed a team of friends and colleagues. Throughout the winter, the Brooklyn Landsharks, their name inspired by a Saturday Night Live sketch, huffed and puffed at indoor pools and on city streets. They hawked T-shirts, catered a Super Bowl bash, raffled off their talents, and publicized their fundraising through Facebook, Twitter, and a website. With unwavering determination, Jed trained at dawn or after work, and he strengthened his body, took it from cuddly to cut. Meanwhile, Nate's treatments proved ineffective, and he began a triathlon of one, chemotherapy, accompanied by self-administered immune-boosting injections. Despite grisly side effects, he took only a handful of sick days. Finally, last May, our family joined thousands near Monterey, California, for the Wildflower Triathlon, an extravaganza with live bands and a Woodstock vibe. The Landsharks raised $34,000, the second largest sum. But the bigger thrill came as I watched Jed tackle the course. The race kicked off with a 1.5K swim, and so many athletes, it took more than an hour for Jed to get it. Now, here were my two men, a team of two linked by love, their emotional stamina as strong as ever. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Good Housekeeping Magazine. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time.